Accession number 7252, reel 3.
Colonel Osborne, reel 3.
As I was saying, the attack went as we expected, insofar that the Italians almost immediately started giving themselves up in large numbers. But there was one lone sniper who unfortunately shot dead my one and only anti-tank rifleman, who fell literally by my side. And he was the only casualty, as far as I remember, we had in that particular little battle. After that, there was no opposition until we reached Asmara, where we were allowed to rest and take a certain amount of recreation for, if I remember rightly, about 3 weeks. And then yet again we were on the move, and this time we went down to the Red Sea and embarked for the Western Desert.
Whilst you were at Asmara, how did the occupying forces behave there?
As far as I remember, they behaved extremely well. There was absolutely no looting. As I said before, I think, for the first few days, until the authorities got wise to it, the existing Italian lira currency was in fact legal currency, and so those who were astute enough managed to buy a certain number of luxury articles, of which were in plenty in the shops. But after that, of course, it was stopped. But no, I don't think that, as far as I remember, it was all very peaceful, and of course one was somewhat weary. And it's a very nice place. It's a lovely climate. It's about 8,000 feet up, Asmara. So you've got nice cool nights. And it was almost like a sort of perfect summer's day during the day.
What did relations seem to be like between the Italians and the Eritreans?
It was a little hard for us to tell, but I think that this depended on the occupation of the Eritreans. I think those who were native Askaris in the army, I think probably in the main, didn't really have a very high opinion of our officers for obvious reasons. But I think the population as a whole really got on very well, because I think the Italians, as administrators, were not the least bit harsh. And because it's not in their nature to be so. I mean, they are naturally sort of gentle people, perhaps not slightly effective. But no, the native population wasn't the least cowed.
How were you greeted, if at all, as you entered Asmara?
Oh, ecstatically. I mean, everybody turned out, Italians and Eritreans.
The Italians themselves greeted you ecstatically, didn't
they? Yes, yes.
Why do you think that was?
Oh, I think, in fact, when I say ecstatically, I mean it was probably more sheer curiosity. But you see, I don't honestly think that the average Italian ever really had his heart in the battle. I don't think it was ever conceived that they would go to war with the with Britain. I honestly don't. And one must remember that what I said before was that the Governor General, the Duke of Aosta, he's no doubt about it, he set the tone, and it was a very pro-British one.
Did you talk to any Italians about the war and what their attitudes towards it was?
No. There was little or no contact, other than I told this good lady to whom I delivered a message from her husband. don't think I discussed it with her. No, there was very little, in fact. I suppose the answer is that we were, quite honestly, we were absolutely physically exhausted. What I can remember really is sleeping most of the time.
Were there, speaking generally now, were there any special problems of handling the troops in East Africa that you wouldn't have had in Europe?
I don't think so, really. I suppose one of the problems was, first of all, mail. I can't really remember, certainly myself, getting any letters the entire campaign, and I just don't think that any trickled through. And I would suspect that that would have had an effect if it had gone on too long. You see, it was a campaign that was, if you like, planned and arranged and geared up in record time. And the logistics of that sort of part of logistics really had to take a back place. And so therefore, not only was there no mail, but there were no refinements at all. I mean, there was no naffy. And the rations were very meagre. But I think we accepted this. We really did. I think there was a general understanding that that sort of thing just had to be forgotten for the time being. And one was more concerned, I think, with actual physical survival and having adequate water. You remember, this climate requires a certain amount of water to be put inside you. And if you're going to sort of react in a proper sort of way, and I suppose this is really what we thought of most.
Were you able to wash frequently?
No. I mean, really, it was another thing. When we got to Asmara, it was the first time we'd seen a shower or had a bath or anything. Certainly since the Karen battle began. And even when we were at Galabatan before, I mean, we had the river to bathe in then, that's true. But certainly no, during the fortnight or 3 weeks of battle, no. I mean, there was no attempt to either wash or shave. You couldn't.
There were no rivers up there.
No. It's a very arid part of the world, very. And yet there is a certain amount of vegetation, and presumably that is because of the fairly heavy dew at night. But I might add that despite the lack of water, the bird life there was unbelievable. I don't think I've ever seen so many birds and such colourful birds as there were there.
Did the troops suffer from any particular sicknesses?
No, I think we were remarkably sickness-free. There was just a little bit of sunburn, this wasn't a problem. No, we remained very fit.
You mentioned morale on a few occasions, but was there ever any time when morale was in question?
The only time, as far as I'm concerned, that there was, shall we say, a slight hesitance in morale was when, as I told you, we were advancing up this steep mountainside to Fort Dorodorodok, and our own barrage fell amongst us. And then there were signs of people having second thoughts. And but again, their morale was strong enough to heed the instruction to go forward. I was fully expecting that there might be, and there was one individual in particular who I had talked to rather sharply.
Why did you have to speak?
Oh, because his reaction was, you know, oh, well, I'm going to go down the hill. I'm going to get killed, sort of thing, and there wasn't time really to sort of to to go into a sort of a detailed discussion with him, obviously.
Was he a private?
Yes, he was a private soldier. And so one used the appropriate terms and shouted with as much authority as one could summon, and that produced the answer. But after that, and there was never any, I never even thought of it. But you see, we realized, of course, that we were in a very key position, and this helped. There's no doubt about it. I mean, if you realize that you're apt in a key position and practice the whole of the operation depends on you and the men's lives as well, well, you react to that. And I might add that, and I should have said this before, that I suppose it's something which, well, I suppose it's one of perhaps three or four instances in the entire war which I remember vividly. It was after we'd been in the fort, I suppose, for perhaps a week, when we were tired, we'd been shot at day and night, and we really were at the end of our tether pretty well. I got a message up from the Battalion headquarters saying that I was being visited, and I really just thought it was the commanding officer. Anyway, I thought no more about it, and one of the many counterattacks was being put in, but it hardly really amounted to very much. Anyway, but it engaged my attention, and suddenly I realised that someone was kneeling or squatting by the side of me, looking over the parapet, and it had a red hat on. So I looked again, and it was Archie Wavell, the Commander-in-Chief. Now, he is, I think, one of the men, one of the generals that really has had least publicity and credit given to him. I mean, he was a man, he was very dour, taciturn, unassuming looking, not a least bit impressive. But it takes a great man to do that. I mean, he must be, what, 60, I suppose, then? So to climb up there. But also from the distance, I mean, he literally, I'm told, he left his Cairo desk and said, no, I must physically be at there. I want to see what's going on. And, of course, it has an electrifying effect. He hardly said anything. He just introduced himself and said, who are you? And I said, he said, well, get on with it then. But he didn't have to say anything.
Now, can you tell me a little bit about relations between the British troops and the other Allied forces taking part in the campaign?
Yes, of course, we were vastly outnumbered. I mean, the British forces were vastly outnumbered by the Indian, as you know. But I can truthfully say that the relationships between us and the Indian forces was of the highest order. To start with, of course, we were both professionals. I mean, we were both regulars. They were all regular too. So that it meant that our soldiers had all virtually been serving in India before. So we knew each other, as it were. And I suppose in some ways the advent of war and being in an actual battle together was the first time, really, that the British soldier had really been in close contact with the Indian. Because, you see, in India before the war, you lived a very sort of restricted life in an Indian cantonment. And the soldier very rarely mixed with the Indian, except on a sort of soldier-servant basis. Now, this was quite different here, because, of course, they were on exactly the same footing. So I would say that really the relationship was an extremely healthy one and very cordial.
What about other types of troops? Did you come into contact with any other categories of troops?
No. No, I don't think we did. Well, I certainly didn't, anyway.
Were there any of the so-called Abyssinian Patriot forces operating with you?
Yes, but not directly. We never saw them. I mean, they did actually take part. Yes, this is quite true. I think in some sort of diversionary way. And I'm not really too sure about that. We certainly never came in touch.
You mentioned the anti-tank weapons, but did you actually ever come across Italian tanks?
Yes. I think it was about the third day, when, of course, my heinous crime, so-called, had been divulged to the commanding officer, and I'd already gotten a reprimand for having. He said, well, you know, what are you going to do if the tanks come up the hill? So I said, well, I don't see how they could possibly get up here anyway. But I must say, I practically had to eat my words a few days later when we heard the rumblings of tanks down in the valley. And I thought to myself, well, this is perhaps where I'm going to catch a cold. But in fact, I don't know what they used them for, but they certainly didn't bring them up to the fort. The Italians did use them in counterattacking elsewhere, but they never used them on the fort.